When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hello and welcome to the first ever episode of The Plays the Thing here from the Close Reads Podcast Network. We are going to be discussing Shakespeare's entire canon, one act at a time. I'm David Kern, and I am joined by Matt Bianco and Tim McIntosh. Tim McIntosh and Matt Bianco, we're still working out who is going to be named first on the show, who gets first billing. But those are the people I'm joined by. Matt, Tim, welcome to The Plays a Thing. Thanks for joining me.
You're welcome.
We are here. to discuss King Lear first. It's going to be the first play we discuss here on The Plays the Thing. And for those who did not listen to the podcast trailer thing that we put up or just haven't heard us discussing it on other podcasts, we are going to be discussing one act for each episode. Thus, each play will take us five episodes. But then we're also going to do a Q&A episode added on to it. So we'll do six episodes over 6 weeks for each play. We'll do about three plays and then we'll take a few weeks off. So it'll be like a three-play cycle.
Where do the cues come from?
From the listeners.
How do the listeners give us cues?
They can do that by contacting us at closereadspods.com or by emailing me at david@cerseinstitute.com, or should they so desire, they can be on the Close Reads Podcast Network Facebook group and they can post their questions there on the Q&A thread for the King Lear conversation.
Perfect. Thanks.
So we will be prepared for that. So as questions come in, feel free to send them to us over on one of those avenues. If you also would like to, you can post a question on social media, Twitter, Facebook, wherever you like. You could do it on Instagram if you want and just use the hashtag the plays the thing. And without the apostrophe, by the way, the plays the thing. And we will check those as well. So we'll be checking those throughout, you know, in between episodes as well, in case something comes up that can inform the conversation. So we're here to talk about Act One, first of all. You guys both jumped at the opportunity to discuss King Lear.
Jumped.
You did. You practically dove in. Dived? You practically dived in.
Dove
in. That's the more Shakespearean way of saying it,
Dave?
I believe. I don't know. Please don't go there. So we were discussing, you know, we've on the Close Reads Podcast Network, in case you're not aware, we have a show that basically covers novels and short stories. And then we also have some poetry things that are going to be happening. We've got some movie pods that we're launching. A lot of stuff that we'll be announcing over time. But as we were looking at all the different books that we're going to be covering, we were trying to figure out, well, who's going to...
Sorry, what are you doing?
Making tea?
Sorry, David. I was finishing my breakfast and I just spilled a fork.
It is 8 a.m. where Tim is right now or something like that. So we'll forgive that. you got up relatively early to be on here. But... What was I saying?
We both jumped to be on Lear. So
we were trying to figure out who's going to be on all the different shows. And when we mentioned that we were going to start Plays the Thing with King Lear, one of his great dramas, you both practically tumbled over each other to get on this show. The good thing is there's space enough for both of you. Why did you want to be on King Lear so much? Tim, are you ready to speak now? Or
I am ready to speak now.
Okay. Jump on this. Why did you want to be on King Lear so badly?
Because it's always in my top three of Shakespeare's plays. I think it might be his, you could make a case that it's his best play. Everyone knows Hamlet. Everyone knows Romeo and Juliet. Lear is a little less known because it's, I think maybe because it's harder to perform. It's denser and it is sad in a way I think that Hamlet is not sad, and maybe not even Romeo and Juliet is sad. It is profoundly sad. I think it's a little bit of an obstacle for people performing
but I think it's brilliant.
Oh yeah, I do. I have to admit, I like it. Well, no, I don't like it. I mean, it's very, very hard for me to watch the end.
Right, right.
But I just think it's...
Conferences,
it's,
Tim and I often watch sad movies and cry together. So
yeah. It's a thing. Yeah.
Yeah. So you just wanted to be able to kind of get on here and relive some of that catharsis that you experienced together while watching performances. Yeah. Hey, Tim, do you have a Mount Rushmore of Shakespeare plays? Like, what are the four Shakespeare plays whose...
profiles are all carved out of granite.
Yeah, exactly.
I do. They are Hamlet, Lear, either Macbeth or Othello, and Coriolanus. They're four tragedies.
Okay, so but do you put, you said either Macbeth or Othello. So does that mean that if you had to only choose four, Coriolanus would get knocked off?
No.
Coriolanus is definitely... So really, it's Lear, Hamlet, Coriolanus, and then one of the other two.
Correct. That's right.
Okay. Right this second, if you had to choose, is it Othello or Macbeth?
Macbeth.
So if you're a theater guy, so for people who don't know Tim, listening to the plays, the thing, and you haven't listened to some of our other podcasts, Tim is a playwright and an actor and a director. And so Tim, when it comes to performing, if you had the chance to perform as any character in one of those plays, and you're doing it like in Stratford-upon-Avon and you're at the Globe and you're going to perform in front of all the, in the greatest Shakespearean venue of all time.
Uh-huh.
And you can choose any of those roles. You've been given that sort of that option. Which of these roles are you going to choose to perform?
Coriolanus. Except if I was, this really is a genuine life goal.
It says a lot about you, I think.
A genuine life goal for me is to play Lear, because if you can play Lear, the actor who plays Lear has to be...
have lived long enough to be old?
Yes. You have to look like you're old enough to go senile, but the actor actually has to be able to memorize all the lines, and it is a bushel of lines. Hmm. And you have to be fit enough, physically fit enough, to actually be a pretty... I see him as being a very physically active character.
That's something, as we talk about this, and I'm going to go over to you, Matt, in just a second. As we talk about this play, I'd love it if you could kind of help us identify that physicality, like where that shows up and where you might see that being portrayed by a performer or laid out by a director.
Yeah.
So just help us see that as we're going through.
Okay.
Let's flip over to Matt now. So we'll do both those questions then. Well, I guess I asked him three questions, but the first question is, why did you jump at Lear? Why does this play mean so much to you that you'd want to spend this much time talking about it with us? And then tell us your Mount Rushmore. And then if you want to tell us which character you'd like to perform, you may as well.
Okay. I actually Tanya Harding'd Brian so that I could be the one on the show. He was trying to, and then I took a crowbar to his kneecap.
Okay. That's what just kind of a general thing that happens.
Less of a jump than more of a
crowbar. Violent takeover.
That's right.
You Othello'd him or Iago'd him?
And I did it because I read Lear a few years ago, very quickly, just in one sitting in an evening.
Oh, wow.
And was very moved by it, but didn't have any outlet for thinking about it further with others. So when it came up, I just knew immediately I needed to do this one so that I could read it again a little more slowly, a little more closely, but also have this outlet with you all.
Yeah.
to be able to discuss it, particularly because of the question that arises about father-daughter relationships, or father-children, parent-child relationships, and wanting to be able to think on those ideas further. So that was kind of the main...
There were specific themes that you just felt like compelled to discuss.
That draws me to this text. Yes. Is it
one of your Mount Rushmore plays?
It is.
What are the others?
It is, especially now, having read it a second time for this. And I imagine we'll grow even stronger as we go through this. But my Mount Rushmore is a little more harmoniously balanced than Tim's. I include some comedies. Mine is my tragedies would be Lear and Hamlet, and then my comedies would be Taming of the Shrew, Much Ado About Nothing, and The Tempest, which gives me 5. So either I need to raise a lot of taxes to modify my Rushmore, or I need to have sometimes this one, sometimes that one. It probably would be Much Ado and The Tempest that I would go back and forth between.
Right this second, which one would you choose? Like, I made Tim choose between Othello and Macbeth.
Yeah, because
right
you're
now.
A jerk. probably Much Ado About Nothing, because I've read that one most recently of the two.
Okay.
But whichever, Tempest is on my schedule to read again soon, and that will probably...
It'll swap
places at that
point. Have you ever felt a desire to perform Shakespeare at all?
Yes.
So which character from those plays, like... having done whatever performance you've done before or having watched performances, seems like a character that you would most like to play?
I performed Othello once.
Did you?
And loved it.
In college, high school?
High school, yeah.
What character were you?
Othello.
I almost said, what position were you? As if it was like baseball. Catcher.
I was Othello. And in high school, that was cool because I got to call a girl a bad name and slap her. Mm. What character would I most want to play?
Coriolanus?
No.
Beatrice?
No. Probably, yeah. Probably Benedict.
Benedict would be a fun character to play.
Benedict would be a blast.
Especially if you have a good Beatrice.
Or Petruchio.
Before we dive, right into Lear, I want to talk a little bit about Shakespearean, like the dramas. I was going to say Shakespearean drama, but I mean that in a very specific way. So Tim, you have all dramas on your list, and Matt, you had 2 of them, and you mentioned that your list was more balanced, but neither of you included a history, for example. So it's not truly balanced.
But aren't the histories all also either tragedies or comedies?
It depends on who you talk to, I suppose.
I mean, they have those kinds of endings.
Well, true. So
it's like they're tragedies, but they have Falstaff in them, so they're so comedic that you sometimes forget it. That's right. I mean, I'm exactly.
Yeah, and I've been calling them dramas, but really what we should be calling them is tragedies. I don't know why I call them dramas. Let's talk about Shakespearean tragedies then. That's the better way. I don't know why I said that, because my mind is not working properly. What about the tragedies? A Shakespearean tragedy is, when it works, is so profoundly compelling. It can't be just that it ends in this tragic way. There's got to be something more going on there. So I'd love to spend 5 minutes on what makes a compelling Shakespearean tragedy so compelling. So I'd like to approach this in a very kind of annoying way. Like, I'd love to come up with 3 reasons, just for the sake of structure and for the sake of, ease.
And for the sake of our lost tools.
Yeah. Well, it's just, it helps my brain. It helps us get to a point, right? It gives us a goal to actually finish something on the conversation and not be here doing this part of the conversation for 30 minutes. So I'm curious if we can come up with 3 good reasons, and we can argue about whether the reasons are good enough, but three really good, compelling reasons why a Shakespearean tragedy, when done right, the best Shakespearean tragedies are so compelling for these 3 reasons. Tim, can you throw one out first?
I would love to throw 2 out, because I think these 2 kind of go together.
Okay.
That's good, because I only have 1.
Okay.
So.
We'll see and then we'll see if we have to fight about anything here.
I'll start at the end. a character that you love dies, and dies in a very, very unjust manner. So that would be one for me. And it just hurts. It really hurts. I mean, Desdemona in Othello is a great example. She's, I don't know, you just can't help but have deep affection and pity for her. And she dies in the most unjust manner. I think now kind of combined with that is the reason for the wrongdoing could very easily have been avoided. But yet, the failure of the character is something that, at least for me, is so identifiable. So just to stick with Othello, it's just insane jealousy. He thinks that his wife, Desdemona, is cheating on him. Iago gives him all sorts of false evidence that she is. Of course, she's not. And Othello just allows himself to be taken in by the green-eyed monster. And I mean, I just think that Shakespeare portrays Othello in a way that I just can see myself going into that. If there's an Iago in my life, I can so easily say, oh, I would just succumb to these little bits of supposed infidelity by Desdemona.
So there's something universal about the way he portrays these failures that we can all see ourselves in the character.
Yeah. And if they would just do differently, if they would just take their eyes off, if Othello would just take his eyes off jealousy, Desdemona would not suffer the fate that she suffers.
So then would you also say then that what makes part of the tragedy compelling is that there is a clear path that any reader can, well, any reader who's paying attention can see as an alternative option that would avoid the tragedy?
Yes.
And that we can see it coming, we can help them avoid it, and we can see that they should avoid it. Okay.
Yeah.
Mostly, maybe.
Okay. Well, let's give you.
Hamlet might be an example, but
okay. Yeah, that's mine. So, yeah.
Well, Hamlet is maybe that's why T.S. Eliot didn't like it.
An exception.
It's a failure as a work of art.
Okay, so you said the character and then the tragic ending could have been avoided, essentially.
Yeah.
So you love the character, but they have a tragic ending, and that tragic ending could have been avoided. Was that one or was that two?
That was two.
Okay, Matt, what's yours?
So my third one is, or mine, which will be the third one, relates to your second one, Tim, which is that I think that there's always a character, or in my experience, I haven't read all of them, but
you think
there's always a character that, and sometimes it's very minor and it's very subtle, but there's always a character that represents that path, that
the positive path, the good
path to that would have avoided the tragedy, that that the audience can, if you can find that character, because like I said, sometimes she's subtle, that the audience can then follow. I mean, that can be to the audience of the virtue to imitate, rather than the negative. The tragic, tragic figure that you can't really imitate him, because then you also would die. Right.
right.
But this other character you can look to as an embodiment of a virtue to imitate. Mm.
Tim, what do you think of that? You're on mute.
I think that's, I was just, as Matt was saying that, I was combing through the tragedies and thinking about who that character was. And I think for the most part, I could come up with, maybe not for Coriolanus. I was having a hard time with Coriolanus, but all of the other tragedies, I think maybe with the exception of Hamlet also, I could think of someone who showed the virtuous path. Are you thinking of Horatio, Matt?
Probably.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's kind of like the idea of a foil, right?
Yeah.
In some ways.
Yeah. Yeah.
But sometimes that character is very subtle. Like I would consider Julius Caesar a tragedy, even though it's a history, but just because of how it ends.
Right.
I would consider it a tragedy, but I think there is a character in there who does this for us. And she's very subtle. There might be two actually, but it's the wives, especially Brutus's wife.
Portia.
But possibly also Calpurnia.
One of the things that, go ahead.
Well, and I think they both like they both seem to indicate that like Portia seems to say, Portia seems to know that if Brutus would just tell her what's going on, he would realize that it's absurd. Mm. That what he's about to do is absurd, but he won't say it to her, won't express it to her. So he's only ever thinking and speaking about it in this echo chamber that is the conspirators. Mm.
One of the things that I love that you guys are pointing out is the way Shakespeare uses these pairs, these relationships to create drama. So like you've got the foil that represents the good path. And then you've also, in many cases, you have like the other, the character that represents the bad path. Mm-hmm. And you see that, you'll see that we're going to see that in Lear. Well, maybe not that specifically, but we're seeing the way he uses these pairs of characters all the time to move the drama forward.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's the father and the child, the father and the daughter, the father and the son in Lear. It could be, you know, it could be two sets of, even in the comedies we see it, you know, you see Beatrice and Benedict, Claudius and Hero.
Right.
You see it in As You Like It. And it's not just that he's pairing them off for the sake of balance,
just mere dramatic effect or dramatic structure.
It genuinely creates the drama, and I mean that in a different way. Like the it creates the stakes, if you will.
You see it in not to go too far astray, but you see it in comedies on television too. Mm-hmm. Like you'll see, you know, one set of characters will be wrestling through some question or some decision. And then there's another set of characters. Like sometimes if it's a family comedy, there'll be like the parents.
Yeah.
And then the kids. Right. And they're both wrestling with the same exact or say a same kind of question. And then, you know, resolving it. Mm.
And when you have, so you mentioned resolution, it seems like one of the hardest things or one of the things that leads to the tragedy or the comedy, you know, the endings that correspond to those things is that idea of resolution. It's either how are these characters going to resolve the tensions in their relationship or how are those tensions in their relationship going to destroy them? And I think that we're going to end up seeing that in Lear as well. Would you agree with that sort of, with that idea, Tim?
That
one of the things that determines whether it's a comedy or a tragedy in some ways is that either the tensions between the characters are resolved or that they're just and then bring them together, or the tensions in the relationship destroy them as people.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, the single demarcation of what is a comedy in Shakespeare's plays is whether or not there's a marriage or marriages at the end. And that's not just, that's true. I mean, the only one that's a little bit hard to categorize that way is Measure for Measure. There's marriages at the end, but it's the main character, Isabella, who strangely does not really give a reply to, I think the Duke is the name of the man who's her suitor. All of the other comedies.
Well, he should have had a real name.
Yeah, right. Bob. All of the other comedies end in a marriage or marriages. Hmm.
Well, let's dive in straight away then. Straight away from here, not from the beginning of this podcast, into King Lear. And I wanted to make a quick note because we got some questions offline, well, I guess actually online, off the show, about the text. And the version that Matt and I are using is the recent version that Pelican produced, the Pelican Shakespeare. It's got a, it kind of looks like a ticket, sort of a ticket stub, I guess. And it's black with a King Lear's head made to look like a castle with a storm, and he's got a beard and all that kind of stuff. It's a cool illustration. Tim, which one are you using? You're using an online version?
No, I did for a little bit, but I went back to a complete Pelican Shakespeare, and it looks like I'm using the same version that you guys are using, which is a combination of the quarto and the folio.
Right. So there's a note on the text in this book, and it notes that King Lear has come down to us in two pretty different versions, with the quarto, which was published in 1608, and a text from the first folio printed in 1623. And the folio, it says, has 115 lines not in the quarto, while the quarto has 285 lines, including a whole scene and a large part of another, not in the folio. And then there are also other smaller variations, it says, that include, that are affecting individual words, speak designations, lineation, and so forth. So I'm just going to read this quick line here. It is generally, though not universally, agreed now that the quarto represents a version of the heavily corrected and revised manuscript that came from Shakespeare's hand, and that the folio represents a later performing version of the play. The implication is that the quarto represents the play before it was performed, the play as it went to the acting company to be transcribed and turned into a performing text, and that the folio version represents the performing text, though not necessarily the only version the company had performed in the year between 1605 and 1623. What we have in our volumes, and which seems from what little research I did that I can tell, so it's not exhaustive, but what little research I did, it confirms what this says here about this text, that the play as presented in this volume is the traditional conflated text. And someone prepared it specifically for the Pelican series. And it seems to have... So it includes both, and it puts passages found only in the quarto text in Roman brackets is what they're called. So there is a companion volume where you can see them as the two different texts. But if you can find the conflated one, that's the one we're going to be using. So we're not going to, I mean, where we remember to or where we can, we'll delineate that we're noting that it's the quarto text or the folio text, but just wanted to make a note about that because there were some questions. So if you're really into Shakespeare scholarship, you can dive into this a little bit more deeply. The history of the folios and all the different texts is pretty interesting. And the way I think about it is like, you'll get a screenplay, say for a movie, this is very common now, and someone writes the original screenplay, but then when you go to shoot it and you start thinking about how the scenes are actually blocked and acted out, you're like, well, that's not going to work. So we need to adjust this slightly or rewrite some scenes. And it seems to be that that's basically what they're doing. Would you say that's true, Tim?
Yeah, I think that's a very good analogy.
Okay. All right. Well, so with that out of the way, then let's talk King Lear. Basically in this first act, should we summarize it in very quickly?
Very quickly.
Very quickly. So Lear is, I'll just start, you guys can add in. It starts with Lear basically having to decide how he's going to divide his kingdom. So he asks his daughters to tell him why, how much they love him. And the right answer is going to get the biggest part of the kingdom. Two of his daughters, Goneril and Regan, answer in a way that satisfies him. Cordelia does not. She essentially gets banished. The king of France has mercy on her and decides that he will marry her.
Without a dowry.
While the Duke of Burgundy decides that's not for him. And then we're also introduced to Kent, who... tries to defend Cordelia and in so doing gets sent off by Lear, who gets angry at him. He then comes back a little later in disguise and tries to become a servant to the king. And then we also have this Earl of Gloucester, who has two sons named Edgar and Edmund, who Edmund is the Earl of Gloucester's bastard son and is intent on causing some problems, it seems. Anything else we need to add to just our brief summary? I mean, it's admittedly extremely brief. We're going to talk about the specific scenes here in a minute. We get introduced to a fool, who is at Lear's side and, as always, is spewing wisdom that Lear can't recognize. Is that enough for us to dive in?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So one of my questions is, in Act 1, Scene 1, it begins with this little like 35 line prologue type thing. And I'm wondering why it even begins with that. Like, why didn't Shakespeare just start with, Lear at line 36, where he starts talking, he gives this, meantime, we shall express our darker purpose. Give me the map. Know that we have divided in three our kingdom. And then he tries to figure out how to do it. But before that, we get Kent and Gloucester and Gloucester's son, Edmund. We get them having this little discussion ahead of time. Kent begins with, I thought the king had more affected the Duke of Albany than Cornwall. So talking about who he likes the most. Why does he begin with this? Why this little prologue type thing going on here?
I think it's a setup for a huge dramatic moment, which is Lear's announcement about how he's going to divide the kingdom, which to a person reading Shakespeare or to a person seeing Shakespeare performed, passing along the rights to rule a kingdom is this potentially calamitous event as a potential war. I mean, I think living in the United States, one of the incredible benefits of living in the United States is we've never had an armed coup in our history. We've had plenty of conflict and nasty conflict, but the exchange of power has, this is incredible in world history, always been a peaceful exchange of power. That is not the norm in human history by a long shot. And so even though, so when Gloucester and Kent are having this discussion, hey, Lear is going to now divide the kingdom, I think for someone seeing this, it's fraught with potential peril.
So it's introducing, so he's just not beating around the bush to get to the conflict. He's trying to reveal why this, why what Lear is about to do is problematic.
Well, I don't even know that he's revealing why it's problematic. I think I think Shakespeare is opening the door for the possibility of massive, massive calamity, which is the case anytime a kingdom exchanges hands. And thus, for an audience, this is a tremendously dramatic moment. What's he going to do? How is he going to do it?
What the first 35 lines though aren't, because we don't know that he's going to do that until line 36, right? 37.
So, well, I guess
it,
in line,
the first 35 lines are like this. Oh no, you're right. I'm sorry.
Line three says, and four. Yeah.
Right. That's right. Okay. Forgive me. Yeah.
So is he sort of saying there, they're kind of talking about the dukes, right? So it sort of seems like, oh, he's going to divide the kingdom between one of these two dukes. Who does he like the best?
Yeah.
Or three dukes or whatever. But then he ends up coming out and talking to his daughters. So it seems like the expectation of Kent and Gloucester is, oh, he's going to have to decide between his daughter's husbands.
Yeah.
But then he comes out and I imagine he kind of surprising everyone. And he says, actually, it's going to come down to which of my daughters answers my somewhat petty question the best.
Now, see, I interpreted that very first line from Kent. I thought the king had more affected the Duke of Albany than Cornwall. I thought that was sort of an indirect way of saying he's going to give more land to Cornwall's wife because he likes the way that she married a little bit better than Albany.
I thought the king had more. So there's a little note here, and I, for one, I'm not ashamed to use notes. I thought the king had more, so we put the note in, preferred the Duke of Albany than Cornwall. I could see that reading, I suppose.
Oh, I said it incorrectly then, David. I'm sorry.
Right.
Had more affected the Duke of Albany. He preferred the Duke of Albany. I switched to say Cornwall. That was a mistake.
Matt, what do you think of that reading?
Well, as far as, like, I read it the same way the note describes it, as far as the thing, as far as which one was preferred. It's the opening scenes of Shakespeare plays always fascinate me because they always seem to be some sort of embodiment, or, well, they always seem to be kind of bizarre, strange, unrelated, with perhaps the exception of Macbeth. And then it's like on a second, third, fourth, fifth reading where you start realizing how closely related it is, or it reveals its secrets, as it were, to how it relates to the rest of the play. So with this one, then, you know, on the first reading, second reading, it's an interesting conversation that you're coming in on where they're foreshadowing, or not foreshadowing, but they're talking about what's about to happen.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that the whole thing seems to be this conversation back and forth, first about which one he likes better of the dukes, but then there's this immediate kind of, or this abrupt interruption where they start talking about Gloucester's son or his sons. But then Gloucester starts talking about which of the sons he likes better, or that he doesn't, right? One is not dearer than the other in his account. Even though one is older, one is younger, one is lawful, one is unlawful. He doesn't hold one dearer than the other. So there's this conversation about liking people more or less, not liking people more or less, being liked by people more or less, not being liked by people more or less. And then Lear comes in and says,
and Kent even says, I must love you more. I got to get to know you more and love you. It's interesting.
Oh yeah.
About the son, very specific line.
Yeah.
And then Lear comes in and says, I'm going to divide my kingdom, and it's going to be based on who loves me more. after we just had, you know, this or this conversation about the, you know, Gloucester and his sons and not loving one more than the other.
And you know what's interesting? I love, okay, so Edmund says, my services to your lordship. Kent then, I must love you and sue to know you better. And then Edmund, sir, I shall study deserving. So in other words, I shall undertake to deserve it.
Yeah.
And so I love this concept that Edmund saying, Kent saying, I need to get to know you. I need to love you more. And then he's saying, okay, then I'm going to work, try to figure out how to deserve that love. So then you get introduced, not just the concept of who do I love more and who do I love less, but who deserves to be loved more and who deserves to be loved less.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know that maybe it's not that much different, but it seems like there's a subtle thematic variation there.
Interesting that it's Edmund too. That's
right. That's yeah. The bastard son. Yeah.
So wise.
So then Lear comes out. And
David, before you go on, yeah. Can I say something?
Yeah.
Because please, this, yeah. I just feel like I need to say this because this is going to be a theme when I talk about Shakespeare. So before Kent's opening line, my text has 1-1, enter King Gloucester and bastard Edmund. So that's the stage directions.
Enter Kent or King?
Mine says Kent.
Yeah, because yeah. King I thought you said King. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, maybe I did. I meant to say Kent.
Yeah.
So those are the stage directions. I think it's really fun and interesting to think, especially once you've gone through the text one time, to think about it in terms of how a director would think about those sorts of stage directions, because the director has got enough liberty that he does not have to have those three characters all entering side by side from the same entrance at the same time by a long shot, that it's probably very rarely performed exactly that way. So
yeah, yeah.
If you're a director, how might you stage that instead? So what I would do, knowing what I know about Kent, the king's top advisor and, you know, one of his most loyal subjects, the man really loves Lear. I might have Gloucester and Edmund standing, you know, like downstage left, already on the stage, and have Kent come out of the same entrance that Lear is about to come out of, because right then you're saying to the audience something about Kent. He knows something that Gloucester does not yet know, or maybe Gloucester does know it, but he's revealing information that he presumably got from the king. And that says a lot about who Kent is. He's a trusted advisor. He gets the information before other people do. So as people go, when we get to new entrances and exits, I think it might be fun for people to kind of stop and imagine, okay, how would I set this scene up if I'm the director? What sort of cues for entrances, especially, am I going to use to show the relationships that are on the stage? Where am I going to put people? What entrances are they going to come from?
Yeah. So I think we may have talked about this previously, but that opening feels to me a lot like it's, you're kind of in the middle of something.
Yes, definitely.
Like they're already in the middle of a conversation. So could you have them kind of be walking on together?
You could
have them in the, like, so, at, you know, maybe the first line is they're not quite to the center of the stage yet. And then as they're going, maybe they're, to where they're kind of settling into they're talking as they're settling into their spots.
Yeah, for the rest of the scene. Absolutely. And I mean, obviously the director has a tremendous amount of liberality given to him in Shakespeare's plays, because Shakespeare uses so few stage directions. Often his stage directions are within the dialogue. And that's another thing that we can look for.
Right, yeah.
You know, a character will say, you know, I bid you well long before the character actually exits. So it's kind of a signal maybe to the director, oh, it's time for this character to start moving off stage.
Yeah. And that's where I've always found that the more I can sense that movement of the words and the language, the play in a way feels less static to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like it helps, because it helps my imagination be moving.
Me too.
It's not just people. It's, you know, like when I think about a novel, there's usually so much description that the scene gets set for me.
Yeah.
And here, there's so much left up to the director, and that's why Shakespeare, you know, unlike other playwrights, can be potentially adapted in modern times just as easily as it could in medieval ages or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's so much freedom granted. And so sometimes it can feel like in my mind, I'm just seeing three people standing there talking to each other.
Uh-huh.
But the more I can visualize the movement and what's going on, the less static, the more alive everything comes to me. So please keep pointing stuff like that out to us.
One bad thing that happens when you start reading this way, David, is that when you see an actual performance, you'll see the director kind of behind the scenes.
You'll disagree.
Oh my goodness. Just a little one. I saw Lear about 2 weeks ago, an outdoor performance. I won't mention where, cause I'm going to be critical. Lear, when he steps on
somewhere
stage,
west of the Mississippi,
right. When Lear steps on stage, he is, I think it's absolutely clear from a director's point of view, he is the central subject of the scene. He's the one that's making the decisions. He's driving decisions. Everyone is reacting to his words. He's not as much reacting to their words. And his words are the law. So when, as we're about to talk about, when he and Cordelia start to have their fight, the director in the play that I saw had Lear, had Cordelia standing still and Lear dancing all around her, like pleading with her, chiding her. And I thought, boy, that choice from the director really reduces the authority of Lear, because it makes the character of Lear appear to be the one who is appealing rather than Cordelia. And I could make an argument, but Cordelia is strong in character and Lear is unhinged in character. And I could understand that. I don't think that would be a great choice though, because we really need to see the authority and the power of Lear and Lear's words really strongly in this opening scene.
And yet one of the things that fascinates me about Shakespeare, and as you pointed out, the lack of stage direction in the text, and then the kind of the freedom that that different directors have and different actors have, is that it's possible to present Lear or any of the characters, Cordelia, anybody, from different perspectives, and kind of lead us to think through what do I learn from this, or what do I think about this story? You know, what's happening in this story if I read it or view it as Lear being this kind of almost childlike,
uh-huh,
desperate for attention type character.
Uh-huh.
But then what happens? How is it different when I read it again or watch it again? And Lear is this kind of commanding, demanding, you know, give me what I want, tell me what I want to hear, uh-huh, or else kind of character. And I'm sure we're coming here. So I guess I don't know to jump ahead too much, but even with Cordelia, right? Like the way she responds, there's different ways to read her character that kind of changed the tenor of the story. That I think it's interesting. Like you know, when people talk about what's better, the book or the movie, and one of the things that people will say is, you know, when I read the book, I'm imagining what the world looks like that I'm in.
Yeah.
Encountering, but when I watch the movie, I have to see what somebody else thinks about it, and I get that, but like this conversation here, where there's the three of us, like we're doing this because, and people are listening to these podcasts because they want to hear how David's imagination,
yeah,
has encountered the world, and how Tim's imagination has encountered the world, and you know, Heidi's, Jonathan's, Angelina's, and mine now, how our imaginations are encountering the world. And so I like that they do that, even though, of course, I'm going to say, well, like you did, I wouldn't do it that way, but it's still fascinating, yeah, what happens, uh-huh, when somebody does, you know?
And the more we love something, the more we feel strongly about it.
Absolutely, right.
Like, right. About the Lord of the Rings, like there's a lot of perfectly, I mean, there's some things that are maybe indefensible, but there are plenty of defensible choices that they make that people in the Lord of the Rings movies that people just can't stand, right?
Yeah,
like where he blocks something, mm-hmm, or whatever, or how, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
That's not for this show. But
hey, before we go on, I mean, this might be a nice transition, Matt. Before we started recording today, you had mentioned the way that you kind of imagined Cordelia when you read her the first time. Remember this conversation?
Yeah, yeah.
I'd love to hear you talk about how you read Cordelia, and if you, you know, upon encountering the play again, if you still read her that way, or if you read her a different way.
Well, this is a good segue to the, because this next bit of scene one has, is Cordelia and Lear kind of going at odds.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So in this scene, of course, Lear says he's going to divide the kingdom, and he asks his daughters to say how much they love him. Whoever loves him the most gets the largest share. Goneril says how much she loves him. Regan says how much she loves him, and that it's the same as Goneril, except with this mistake that Goneril made. And then she corrects it, right? And then Cordelia says that there's nothing she can say, and basically justifies it by saying two things, I think. One, that she can't heave her heart into her mouth and turn her emotions into words, but also there's an amount of love and duty that's appropriate to a father from his daughter, and that she's not going to go beyond that. And she thinks that her sisters have. And so she can't love him as much as he seems to be wanting. And so the first two times now that I've read it, both times I've read Cordelia as being this kind of almost stoic, duty bound, you know, a strong woman who has a sense of duty and honor, and that she's just telling her father how it is. And she's not going to give and budge either way. But when we were having this conversation earlier off the air, it occurred to me that you could also read her, and I think you confirmed that you've seen her play this way, that you could read her as actually feeling a little bit more, saddened by that, like there's a sense of duty, that a sense of appropriateness, propriety, that she's not going to overstep, but she's saddened by that she can't, or that there's this need, there's even a need to, and so she, it's almost like a pitiful appeal to a pitiful appeal. Unhappy that I am, I cannot heave my heart into my mouth. I love your majesty according to my bond, no more, no less. And you could almost hear her in a kind of weeping type tone, or a tone of great sadness there, rather than a stoic,
yes,
I cannot heave my heart into my mouth. You're asking me to do something I ought not do. You know?
And I found myself reading it as if she's kind of like more of a spitfire, like, I don't have time for this nonsense type thing. I don't know why I read that in my first, especially those first few readings when she's kind of, those first few lines rather, when she's sort of talking to herself, like she's being, I almost read it as if she's being sort of sarcastic and thinks this whole thing is sort of nonsense. But so what I'm wondering is, like, do you guys think that there is a way to read Cordelia that one of these is right, one of them is wrong, or that it says more about us and how we read her?
I think it says more about us. That, my gut instinct is that we interpret her a certain way, and then it communicates something about the way we think about that kind of a situation or that kind of a person, especially if it's a character where we can identify ourselves with that person.
Or the kind of woman that appeals to us.
So that's what I typically think that is typically what happens. Like when Hamlet says, you know, the play holds a mirror up to our nature, that in a sense, the play is a mirror to my own personal nature, right? And, or to my person, and that it's communicating something about me. So if I see, you know, Hamlet as a certain type of person, it might be communicating something about what I am, the kind of person I am.
I guess the great thing about this is part of the fun of the reading experience is saying, this is my instinct of what's happening here.
Yeah.
And now we keep reading and we test it against, hey, what comes
absolutely
next?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And you can keep going back and reading it, and you can read it, the play, in so many different voices even. And that's why so many different performances can all ring so true. I mean, some of them probably ring very hollow. But there's many performances of many great characters that can be slightly or significantly different, that can still feel like they're capturing what he's going for, which is so fascinating.
Matt, there's something else that you said that ties in with what David just said before we did this recording about kind of the relationship of the Christian to the scriptures. Like, do you remember this? The kind of like playfulness or the freedom that is kind of within the scripture. Maybe you could say a little bit more about that. I really appreciated what you had to say.
Yeah. I don't remember where I got this from, but it was one of those situations where, like, earlier in my life where I was really struggling with, you know, I need to know what God's will is, if God wants me to take this job or if he wants me to move here or if he wants me to do this thing. And as if taking a job in whatever, New York City, was somehow, well, maybe New York City is a bad example. As if taking a job in, you know, somewhere in, you know, some city in North Carolina would be a sin. And like I was afraid of it in that way. And then I read or I heard somewhere that with things like that, like it's almost better to imagine life as kind of like you're on a playground.
Yeah.
There's this fence around the playground, and that fence really represents, you know, God's law, as far as like to cross the fence is when you're actually breaking one of God's laws and sinning. But there are all these pieces of playground equipment inside the fence that you're not sinning. You're not sinning if you choose the monkey bars over the slide or the swings. And in fact, insofar as, you know, we understand God as Father, it's almost like God as Father is watching to see which his child will choose. Like, what is it that, you know, that you love? Do you love the monkey bars or do you love the swing? and there's this sense of joy even that he gets when he sees what we choose. Like when we take our little kid to the store and we, you know, put him in front of a shelf and say, you know, which piece of candy do you want or which toy do you want? And then, and then the joy that we get in seeing him pick that thing, like, oh, he loves this thing, right?
Yeah.
We learn something about him in that moment. And I wonder if
it's not like you're going to put two toys in front of them, and then if they choose the one that you don't like, then you're going to like be like, no, you can't have that. Or when we go home, I'm going to toss that in the trash, and you're going to go in timeout.
Yeah, because you picked the wrong thing.
Yeah, you picked the wrong toy.
Wanting you to pick.
Yeah,
yeah, it's like that. And so I was wondering if Shakespeare writes in such a way, and part of my reason for thinking this is the lack of stage direction. It writes in such a way that it's almost like he wrote the play, then he wants to sit back and watch and see how directors and actors will play it out. Like, are you going to play Cordelia as this kind of stoic figure or this sad figure or this snarky figure? You know,
well, that comes back to the two texts though, doesn't it? Like, he wrote the first one and then there's another one that seems to have been adjusted as they were performing it.
Oh, right.
So it's like he brought it to them and he saw the choices they were making and the choices that the demands of the stage necessitated.
Yeah.
He adjusted it. And like, it seems like that's part of that process is probably very enjoyable for him to see the way the performers are interacting with it and making choices and how the audience is responding to different things.
And you, I think you've told me too, Tim, that you've had that in the plays you've written.
Oh, right, all the time.
You've had to make changes because the actors show you something
all the time
by their choice. Yeah. Amazing.
Sometimes I think about Shakespeare. I think any one of these plays that we've kind of mentioned in our Mount Rushmore, if he had just written one of these, I think we'd probably know his name. Maybe. Probably know his name, because they are just works of a transcendent genius. They're absolutely superb.
Like Marlowe, right? We know the main, the
exactly primary. Right. Yeah. Right. Cause it's just a superb work. But sometimes I think about, oh my gosh, was he superhuman? Because we don't just have one, we have 37, 38, depending.
That's why there's an authorship debate.
Right. It seems unbelievable, but I do believe in a single authorship. A man named William Shakespeare wrote all of these plays. And I think that part of the reason that they are so powerful is because he's working with a troupe, an ensemble of what were probably the greatest actors in the world. I mean, the best theater scene, I think, in Europe at the time was kind of widely acknowledged to be London. So he has these characters, these actors. There's a man named Kent who plays all of the clown roles in Shakespeare's scenes. And he's just heralded as, you know, like one of the great clowns in acting history. So he has these wonderful actors. And I think that what he gave them, the texts that he gave them, were exemplary. But I think that they probably moved to another level because he's working with these outstanding actors who know how to make a play come alive. And my hunch is it was more of a collaborative process than we typically give Shakespeare credit for. Mm-hmm. And he was an actor, of course. We all know. I don't know that we know what, we probably do know what role he played in this play. He played the ghost, the ghost's voice in Hamlet, apparently. So he's an actor also. And so he knows not just the craft of writing, but the craft of performance.
That would be very interesting if someone wrote a paper on the characters that Shakespeare played and what that means about how he might have thought about the plays.
There's a book called The Best Actors in the World, which is basically just an empirical study based on, you know, posters and playbills about who they think played these various roles. And the author, it's a little bit of a dry book. It's an academic book for people other than me. But he submits, I think that Shakespeare played this role in this play, this role in this play.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about this scene here. We've got a little bit of time left, probably. Scene one's quite long, so I think it's worth a lot of the focus here in this conversation. What do you make of this question Lear asked them? Like, what does it tell us about Lear himself that he seems to change the plan on his advisors and decides to divide his kingdom up based on how his daughters respond to the question? Essentially, the question is, how much do you love me? What do we know about, what can we learn about Lear by this question? And I mean, heck, should he have asked this question?
Which one of you loved me best?
Yeah, I mean,
no.
It seems like, so the answer seems obvious, right? This is a crazy way to divide up the kingdom. Matt, do you agree that it's nonsense?
Well, I want to hear Tim explain his no, because I don't. My answer is also no, but I think it's a softer no.
It's not as obvious.
So I want to hear Tim.
Tim's was almost like mocking the question.
Right.
Like,
right. No, and you're an idiot if you think otherwise. And I want to be the idiot today. So,
well, okay. Two things are going on. One of them is a procedural question of governance. Mm-hmm. Who is going to get the kingdom and how much of the kingdom they're going to get. And there's the other question, which is the question of relationship, familial love, et cetera, et cetera. And they're mashed together, which is part of the reason this play is going to be so great, is because he's mashing these two things together and you can't separate the two.
I was thinking about how basically the question, like, it seems like at the outset that, like Henry V or something, it's going to be a play of political intrigue, right? Possible political intrigue.
Yeah.
And then within 50 lines, it's actually a family drama.
Yeah, right. And I mean, I think this is why it's so intriguing, because you know it's never as simple as, okay, is it going to be Goneril? Is it going to be Reagan? Is it going to be Cordelia? Well, all three are up for grabs. And how does Lear determine the question? By trying to determine which one of them loves him the best. So I think it's crazy, not from the procedural governance point of view, but from the familial love point of view, just because I know that parents are in their heart of hearts, they don't like to admit it, but they often have a favorite child. Lear very clearly has a favorite child of these three, and it's Cordelia. He says so, his advisors say so. The thing that's crazy to me is that I think there's kind of like a recognized parental, silence about articulating who the favorite child is, because you love your children. A parent loves his children. And to make them play favorites is to breed seeds of catastrophe through jealousy and rivalry among your kids. So I think it's crazy because Lear is violating that kind of parental rule. and that's bad enough. But the stakes at which he violates it are the ruling of an entire kingdom. So that strikes me as, it's not madness like crazy. It's just, it's beyond unwise.
Matt?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I agree with Tim wholeheartedly, actually, and especially with regards to the appropriateness or the propriety of what he's doing and the way he's doing it, especially with regards to the daughters, the filial aspect of it. I think that what he's doing is inappropriate, but I think that what he's doing is, I'm sympathetic to it.
You can recognize the humanity in it.
Yeah. Yes. I recognize the humanity in it. And I don't think that we're supposed to believe that King Lear is a bad person, or maybe there's a better adjective to use there. I don't think we're supposed to think less of him at all
because he does this.
I think that King Lear is a good king, has been, is, and would be, will be, might be,
depending on your degree of spoiler,
right?
Caution.
But there is a moment here where I think we're supposed to pause at that. We're supposed to take pause at what just happened. But I don't know that we're supposed to think this guy is an idiot or this guy is off his rocker. And he just made a colossal mistake, even though I think he did, but I don't think it's supposed to, Aristotle says one sparrow does not a summer make. I think this kind of small sequence of events, brief sequence of events that we're going to encounter for the next few acts is not supposed to overwrite the overall character of the man.
We're not supposed to look at him as like some kind of morally corrupt person but he's making an unwise decision.
Right. He's giving into some human things that kings ought to instinct. Give into. Yeah.
Yeah. But what about this idea? So his first line is, meantime, we shall express our darker purpose. And I can't get past that line. It's just so like, I mean, the note says here, it means secret plan, right? But like, why didn't Shakespeare just say, I mean, certainly poetic reasons, but meantime, we shall express our darker purpose. And there's something mysterious about that. Something feels like he is admitting to the audience or to himself. I could almost see that line being sort of played where he's just saying that line to himself. And then he turns to his people and says, give me the map there.
Just a quick side note. Notice he's just kicked Gloucester out of the room at this moment. To Tim's point earlier about Kent being the one that has all the knowledge, that knows things before everybody else does, that he's the main advisor and he and Gloucester are speaking. And then the first thing that Lear says to Gloucester is, hey, go wait on those guys out there. Mm-hmm. Go make sure, go show them some hospitality.
Make sure you take your kid.
This meeting. Yeah. And then the kid, yeah. And take your rotten son with you. And so you also get this peak that Gloucester's not that important of a person, it in Lear's mind at least, in the hierarchy of the relationships there. So Gloucester and Edmund aren't even there when all of this goes down. And then Lear says, okay, now I'm going to tell you my secret plan, or I'm going to tell you my darker purpose, which, so are you asking that in light of what I just said though? about being a bad guy, but here he seems to be saying using adjectives that indicate I'm about to do something very, very wicked.
Well, I'm wondering if maybe it's just, and you know, that's why I said you could almost see him saying it to himself. Like he's cluing in the audience that maybe he doesn't fully realize what he's doing or what he's saying, but there seems to be something darker here. And I know like blindness is a theme in the play, darkness, blindness.
Right.
I think Tim, you've mentioned that before.
Yeah.
And so this plays into that. Well, what do you make of this line, Tim? Meantime, what do you think of my idea that could be said to the audience sort of almost as an aside? And then when he's talking to his people, he's turning to them and saying, give me the map there.
Well, I think that would be a really bold choice for the director. I think that the plain reading, the plain meaning, I should say, is not darker, like morally suspicious. I think it's simply, I have a secret plan. I am now going to unfold it. So if the director has Lear speak that line, our darker purpose, as an aside to the audience, well, the audience is going to say, oh my goodness, what is it? Oh my goodness, what is it? He's got a darker plan. And I would think as an audience member that when he reveals who's going to get what part of the kingdom, that that's not really what the secret plan, he's not really revealing the secret plan. The secret plan is going to happen later. So I would not do that, because I think you would have your audience begging to know, okay, what's the real secret plan? Because it wasn't.
Because in doing that, he says we're going to express it right now.
Yeah, right. So I think you'd kind of like tell the audience, you and I know that this is not really what my purpose is, which I don't think that'd be a good reading of the text. I think you'd have a pretty confused audience on your hands.
Okay, so let's turn to Cordelia then. I mean, we just talked about her a little bit, about how you might read her. But her answer, was it wise? I mean, did she answer the right way? Either of you, jump in there.
Oh, man.
It's a tough, I mean.
No!
I mean, I think really how you answer this question says a lot of how you're going to read the rest of the play, right?
It's kind of ridiculous. Like, if my wife came up to me and said, why do you love me? And I said, because I've promised to, because of duty, because I vowed it.
You're going
to
be like, what?
My wife would be like, what? I followed Kant's rules about, you know, what love, then the only love that's truly love is love because of duty, out of a sense of duty. If I told my wife that, she would probably, or she would be probably pretty annoyed with me.
And justifiably so.
And justify it. Like, I should be able and willing to say that I love you because you're beautiful and you're smart and you're funny and you
like spending time with
babies I like spending time with you. You make the days go easy. Whatever, you know, all those things. And then, you know, I love you so much, I would die for you and whatever. Right.
This is where it proves that it's not a romance, right?
Yeah. Right.
The understanding of love is a little bit weird.
And Cordelia, who is to me, Cordelia is that side character that represents that virtuous character that we can imitate.
The right path.
But just from the human side of it, like trying to enter into, you know, King Lear's, the story and his, and be like having a sympathetic emotional experience with him, with the characters, like there is a sense in which she loves her father. She knows her father, and she knows that what he needs to hear right now. And my wife needs to hear something more than just, I love you because of a vow I made 22 years ago. She needs to hear that I love her because she's beautiful.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
So you can empathize with the human part of what he feels when he hears what she says.
What Cordelia says. Yeah.
Like you understand that, yeah.
And Cordelia's being Kantian at this point for no reason.
Cordelia's being truthful, but not, she's not tapping into like the human side of things.
Okay, let me, can I, Dave?
You want to counter that?
If she's not a Kantian character driven by this like deontological system of ethics, and she's actually
say that sentence again a bunch of times.
She has deep affection for her father, which I think there's textual evidence to support that.
Yeah.
Well, then why does she respond the way that she responds? Like, in other words, if she's not a Stoic, why these words?
So, I mean, does the answer depend on how we read her? Do we read her if either as a Stoic or as this person who's, you know, saddened by her inability to say? I mean, do we accept that? We could accept that she wants to tell him more and she's incapable of it. She cannot heave her heart up into her mouth. Not, she will not heave her heart up into her mouth.
She's just, it's, she lacks a skill.
She's poetically incapable.
Yeah, see, right. This is kind of getting at why, in some ways, I read her like she doesn't have, she thinks that what's happening here is silly and she's not going to like, she respects him as a person, but recognizes that he is maybe like, I think you could say that maybe here she's recognizing the trajectory of his.
Yeah. But my mind. Wife would slap me if I said that, if I did that to her, if I was like, but you're being silly. So I'm not going to answer your question.
Right. So I'm not saying that his response is not like that. The way he responds to her is completely wrong. But I think her response at the same time is she's recognizing where his mind is going. And she's saying, I'm not going to honor the nonsense that you're putting out here. I've got too much respect for you to say that this is really you putting this question forward.
Yeah.
Or she also knows that there are two men standing in wait.
That she doesn't want.
And well, if she says, I love you more than anybody, then which of those two men would be willing to marry her?
Right. So she's being pragmatic.
Right. She might be being very pragmatic. I can't tell you what you want. Like Goneril and Reagan can because they're already married.
Oh, right.
But I can't tell you that I love you more than any future husband.
And because their husbands want right the power here. Too. Yeah. So for her, she's like, this is a rock and a hard place you put me in. What do you want me to do?
Could be. Yeah.
Huh.
Or.
And all this stuff is stuff we can think
or
about.
Or the most virtuous reading is that she actually is a very virtuous lady who has a sense of duty and a sense of love for propriety. Her father and propriety. And she's responding with great propriety. And that's my normal reading, but I'm, you know, if I'm trying to think through.
Yeah. Different options
and just the way the different characters might feel emotionally in the situation.
But this is the beauty of Shakespeare, right? Like absolutely. Any of these, we can look at any of these and there's a justifiable case to be made, at least within the context of the scene. Obviously we're going to keep reading and see where it goes.
And I think that the best way to read Ophelia is that it is a sense of
not Ophelia, Cordelia.
Excuse me, Cordelia is that it
is a very different character.
Oh yeah. She's responding. She perhaps lacks the skill to respond appropriately, that she's more gifted at love, which we all should be more gifted at love than we are in rhetoric. So that's, she says, part of the problem. But I also think that she is a character of propriety, especially because the two speeches from her sisters that have come before are so full of impropriety, not impropriety, like sexual impropriety. They just are outlandish and ridiculous. I kind of think
they're
it'd be
pandering.
Worth a little bit of it. But they're pandering in a way that is... it's bizarrely inflated. Give me a second, because I just think...
Yeah, it's line 55 is Goneril, and Reagan is line 69.
Great.
And I'm fascinated by the fact that these are both their first two lines, like their first lines of the play.
Yes.
Hmm. I'm always very interested by the first line someone says in a play, especially like a key character. I don't know.
So Goneril...
First time we meet them.
Responding to Lear's desire to know who loves him best. Goneril, sir, I do love you more than words can wield the matter. Dearer than eyesight, space, or liberty. Beyond what can be valued rich or rare, sir, a son for her cradle ere she had a husband for her bed. I mean, what? I mean, it's so...
She loves him
more than eyesight, space, and liberty?
Where's the bed part?
Oh,
that might be an example
from a different text.
Oh, okay. Read yours again after the liberty part.
Oh, hold on. Sir, I do love you more than words can wield the matter. Dearer than eyesight, space, or liberty, beyond which can be valued rich or rare. Now, this is really strange because in my copy, I jump a column and it says, sir, a son for her cradle, but that doesn't make much sense. That seems like a real
Yeah, that's not in ours.
Oh. Here we go. David, can we take this out so I can just read the whole thing properly? I didn't realize this Penguin Classic has put them side by side, the Folio and the Quarto.
Oh, okay.
So here I go again. Goneril responding to Lear, who loves me best? Goneril says, "Sir, I do love you more than words can wield the matter. Dearer than eyesight, space, or liberty, beyond what can be valued, rich or rare, no less than life with grace, health, beauty, honor, as much as child e'er loved or father, friend, a love that makes breath poor and speech unable, beyond all manner of so much, I love you." She's saying that she loves him more than eyesight, space, or liberty. Which is
they're not even like things
or reaching.
She's like, I love you more than any words could possibly say. And then she just lists a bunch of words.
I know. Right. I think, when I see Lear, I mean, I kind of already know what Goneril is going to be like, but when I hear these opening lines from Goneril, I'm like, oh, she is willing to say, not only is she willing to say anything, but her choice of words is so beyond the pale of what that relationship should be like. It's so kind of like beyond nature. It seems to me like a violation of nature, and we can talk about what nature means later. That I think the audience hears Goneril and they're just like, oh my gosh, she's willing to say anything to get her hands on land. This has nothing to do with her affection for Lear. Mm. And so by contrast, Cordelia can only barely speak. Why? Because she says, my love's richer than my tongue. Or in another translation, my love's more ponderous than my tongue.
Translation.
Edition.
Oh. And then there's Reagan. Matt, you want to read Reagan?
Yeah. Yeah. Now Reagan responding to Lear's question, how much do you love me? I am made of that self metal as my sister, and prize me at her worth. In my true heart, I find she names my very deed of love. Only she comes too short. That I profess myself an enemy to all other joys, which the most precious square of sense possesses, and find I am alone felicitate in your dear highness' love. So basically she's saying, I love you. All those things are true of me too, but all the things that she says she loves you more than, I love you more than them, and now I hate them. Uh-huh. She still loves those things. I hate them. Right?
Eyesight is an enemy to me.
I'm made. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then she's saying, but also, I'm also made. I love the fact that you love me. That's the end part there, right?
Oh yeah.
I find I am alone felicitated in your dear highness love. So I'm alone made happy by your dear highness love. Is that how would you read that part? It seems to me that she's saying something like, it's at line 75 and 76.
I'm alone made happy in your dear highness love. Yeah. So she's only happy when she has his love.
She's like turning it. She's giving him more agency to him there.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because after Goneril speaks, Lear then, before he even turns to Reagan, he gives her Goneril a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
So it's almost like Reagan's like, oh, okay, that worked. I'm just going to do the same thing and pile on.
Right.
And then he doesn't, it's not like Lear waits to hear them all speak and then gives them stuff. He hears Goneril speak and gives her something. And then he hears Reagan speak and he gives her something. And then he turns to Cordelia. And she's like, eh, I'm good.
That's why I think this whole thing was a hoop jumping contest. By Leary. I think he already knew what portion Goneril was going to get. He already knew what portion Reagan was going to get. And he already knew that the remaining portion was going to be Cordelia's and it was going to be the largest.
So he's testing her.
So he makes there's no changes here. I'm not even sure he thought he was testing her. I think that he went into it assuming that he would hear what he wanted to hear, that he would get answers.
It's just,
and this was more just of a display of a display, well, I hate to make this comparison because he's a bad guy, but but like in the book of Esther, where the king is parading his wife around, I can't remember her name, the first queen, before Esther before Esther becomes his queen, and he's parading her around. Like, it's almost like that. Like, he's putting them on display.
Yeah.
But he knows that Cordelia is, because Cordelia is his favorite, and he knows that she's going to love him the most. He knows that she's going to get the most. And so he doesn't even have to worry about how he's going to divvy it up until Cordelia surprises him and doesn't give the answer that he's expecting. And then he has to take her share, the largest share probably, and then divide it into two and pass it off to, and, you know, split it between the other two. Hmm.
Okay. So following this, Burgundy's like, just because for time here, Burgundy's like, I'm good. I don't want to marry her now. She speaks her mind a little too much. No dowry. Peace. Then the King of France is like, I like that she speaks her mind. I'll take her off your hands. And then Kent jumps in to defend King, the way Lear responds, and then gets banished. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of how.
Yeah,
so,
there's a note there, a point there, though, because this is fascinating to me. So Lear does this whole thing, then, and Cordelia tries to explain that this is not right.
Yeah.
Then Kent steps in and says, this is not right. You should not be dividing up your kingdom yet. And you shouldn't be doing it in this way. And both Cordelia and Lear and Kent get banished from Britain. Then a couple scenes later, the fool comes in, says all the exact same stuff.
Yeah.
And the king does nothing about
it. Okay. So I have a proposal to make. We're going on, it's like an hour and 20 minutes of show right now. And we did some of that remedial, like some of the previewing Lear stuff, but for about 30 minutes at the beginning. So what if we were to take a pause here and make this first episode act one, scene one, and then finish act one in a second episode?
I think that's a really good idea.
Because I think that way, because I think we need to do a good job on act one. I think the future acts, we won't have as much stuff at the beginning. We can dive right in. So let's pause here and let's finish our conversation on act one the next time, and we'll try to go 45 minutes or whatever whenever we get a chance.
David, can I kind of, you finish?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
There's a word that shows up with great frequency in this play, and it's the word nature. And
that's why I wanted to focus on scene two.
Yeah, because scene two, Edmund, the bastard son of Gloucester, who is a bad guy, he calls himself kind of like the in allegiance with goddess nature. I can't remember the exact
to that law my services are bound. Yes. It's line act one scene two line one.
I'm just thinking that a lot of our listeners kind of come from the Christian classical tradition, and that word nature is held up as something to be esteemed. It's, you know, we read Hamlet say, hold up a mirror to nature, and we say, and nature's good. That's a good thing to hold up a mirror to nature. So it's very peculiar and potentially kind of confusing to hear Edmund, who we know really early on is a bad guy intent on destruction, to hear him say, thou, nature, art my goddess, to thy law my services are bound. So I'm mentioning this because I think it would be helpful to listeners to try to understand what Shakespeare means by nature. And it is not simple. And then another complexity to that is Shakespeare puts plenty of wonderful words in just dastardly characters' mouths. Hmm. So going forward, I think the three of us would behoove us well to try to understand how Shakespeare is using the concept of nature. I don't mean nature, the outside world, but the concept of nature. What does it mean? And what does he hope that we understand?
Hmm. Yeah. And along those lines, because by the time we get to scene two, we are also aware, we have also been made aware of the fact that this play, or that this kingdom, exists in a pre-Christian time, right? They make appeals to
pagan
Apollo,
deities,
Hera, Jove, or whatever, Jupiter, pagan deities. So what does that mean as well for the text, that you have a Christian writing a play to a Christian audience, but the play is set in a pagan setting. And so what does that mean as well? And in light of, you know, all of the stuff that's happening and these encounters with ideas like nature and stuff. So
yeah, it's kind of a comparable problem to the one that those readers that are familiar with Beowulf are encountering. Like, okay, this seems to be a Christian author speaking into a Christianized, but still kind of pagan culture. There's a lot of like pagan influence. Yeah. So there's this kind of like very tricky hermeneutical question of like, well, what do you do with that? How do you make sense of that kind of mashup between paganism and Christianity?
Yeah. I love this. I think those are some great things we're going to have to dive into. And I wanted to give scene two and then the stuff with the fool. I don't want to give it too little time. So I think that'll give us a chance to focus on it at least for half hour, 45 minutes. Before we go though, I want to talk about one idea that I think will be able to help guide us in a lot of these Shakespeare shows. There's a kind of a, what Tim would call kind of a technical term that Matt, you and I talk about. We talk about around here when we talk about books. It's this idea of what we call a necessary question. If you've used our Iliad or Odyssey guides, you'll have seen them before. And I think that, Matt, can you just give a one sentence summary of what a necessary question is? Because what I'd love for people to be able to do is as they're reading and thinking about Act One, to be able to think about what maybe the necessary question for King, what Shakespeare is suggesting as the necessary question for King Lear might be.
Yeah, but the way we use the necessary question in our reading guides, our literature guides, and here, I guess, is what is some concrete act or decision that is made in the play that is the necessary question with regards to, you know, should he do it? Should he not do it? Should he have done it or have not done it? And then that question seems to be continually getting answered. As you progress through the play, it's continually getting answered or more information is being added to the question to help us.
So the question keeps coming back because something happens because of the decision that was made or whatever.
Right, we get new information that affects our decision. The question itself is rarely ever actually answered by the author, but it's this question that as you're asking it, as you're reading through the play or the story and asking it, it then gives rise to these bigger ideas and these bigger questions that might come up. Like I mentioned at the beginning that, you know, this King Lear raises questions about family, you know, father-daughter relationships, parent-child relationships. So this is kind of bigger idea, but identifying that necessary question and trying to answer that as I'm reading through the text would raise in my mind, these bigger idea questions, more abstract questions.
Yeah. So it should be something concrete, essentially concrete that can give rise to the abstract ideas, abstract themes. Right.
So can I ask a clarifying question? I just saw the movie, The Incredibles on the plane back from Colorado, which I had never seen before, which was fantastic. What a movie. It was so good. What's the necessary question of The Incredibles? I just assume you guys have seen it.
I have not seen that in a while, so I can't even remember.
It's been so long. I have no idea.
But
sorry, man.
So like, for example, Casablanca, let's talk Casablanca.
Yeah,
like,
right.
That's one that people have seen. You could say that you could argue that the necessary question is, should Rick help Ilsa and her husband? Should he put his neck on the line to help them escape? So that's a very practical, specific question that's going to affect what eventually happens to him. But it's also a question that's going to give rise to discussions about things like justice and injustice. Things, abstract ideas that relate to the story. So you can ask that specific question as a gateway into some other more abstract ideas.
Right.
So then.
So in Othello, you know, should Othello go along with Iago?
Yeah.
Should Hamlet trust the ghost or believe the ghost?
And at the beginning,
it's a question about the main character's decisions and actions from those decisions.
Mm-hmm. And as we see more of the effects of the decisions that they made, you can start at you, the way you think about the question begins to evolve, and it opens up new abstract ideas, new abstract themes to be talked about.
And there, I mean, you got can, it. So
it's a framework for discussion, and basically
the question can be asked of a question like this can be asked of any decision that's ever made in the story. But there's this one that we kind of think of as the necessary question, which is that main one that, you know, that the author is building the whole story around.
That seems to be the one that is most interesting to the author in some ways, I think is.
Yeah.
It's the one that the author seems to be the most concerned about. It lingers the longest, it twists and turns. As you twist and turn through the story, it still seems to be there. It's one of those things where right now we're just saying, let's look out for it. Let's try to figure out what is possibly Shakespeare saying is the necessary question of Lear. I'm not saying right now at the end of Act 1, Scene 1, we should know, but it's just something that's worth looking out for and is worth potentially providing a context for some conversation.
Yeah.
And if you're a teacher, or someone who just likes, you know, you have a book club or whatever, it's a great way to focus your conversation, especially with younger, you know, say your high school students, middle school and high school students, because you're starting with the concrete and then you're going to the abstract.
Right.
Which is a better way of approaching things with kids who are, you know, many kids are not necessarily going to be inclined to start with the abstract and stay there.
Yeah.
They're not capable of it.
For teachers and parents, I guess, just as a side kind of note, that younger kids, like junior high kids, but also high school kids, perhaps on their first read, the necessary question, like kind of that main one, might be difficult to find. And so, you know, having them practice on just asking the question about any event or decision can be a helpful starting point. But then as they get older and more experienced with stories, and then especially as they're rereading stories, you know, on the second and third or fourth time, finding that necessary question becomes easier and easier. So this strikes me. Is it right or wrong? But be careful with that, I guess.
As you guys explain it, it strikes me of this could be a really helpful thing to pursue in class, because as soon as you ask the question, David, what's the necessary question to play? So I start thinking about, well, you know, maybe it's something like Lear wants to divide his kingdom peacefully. But as soon as, if I'm imagining myself as a student in the class, the moment that I say that, then another student says, but that's not what it's really about. It's about his broken relationship with Cordelia. You know what I mean? So, So it's an opportunity. It seems to me like that's a great way to get the students invested in what is really happening here. What's really going on here?
Yeah, you know, like one great place that you see it is in one really obvious way is the novel Huckleberry Finn, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Because the big question is, you know, maybe the necessary question is, should Huck turn Jim in or help him go free? And so on the surface, you know, you might say it might seem obvious what the answer to that question is. But in discussing it, it forces kids to think outside their own perspectives and to ask new questions and to say, it's just a book about adventure or whatever. You know, it forces the kid who thought, you know, maybe that they were just reading it and they were just enjoying the adventure to think more deeply about it too. So,
well, you asked the question, you know, should Cordelia have responded the way she did? And I mean, even there, like Tim, you and I both had initial kind of gut reactions, right? But then as we're discussing, it's like, well, but was she thinking about this, or was this influencing her? You know, was she being pragmatic because there were suitors standing there?
Or
right outside the door or whatever, you know?
It takes you have to think not just about how you think about it, but how the characters think about it. Like you just be somebody else for a while.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is one of the large points of literature.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
All right, Matt, final thought, and then we got to go.
Yeah, I cut you off, Matt.
No, I don't have a final thought, but apparently there's an eavesdropper on the podcast booth, and somebody had slipped a note underneath the door, which note reads, T.S. Eliot liked Hamlet. He thought it failed as a work of art because it tried the impossible. So apparently our eavesdropper overheard David say that maybe that's why T.S. Eliot didn't like Hamlet way earlier in the show. And then we get a note slid under the door. So.
Yeah.
So Brian Phillips, I guess Brian Phillips, there's no way that that was Andrew Kern. I didn't know that Brian Phillips
he would never do that. All right. Well, gentlemen, thanks to both of you. We went a little long, but I think this is, you know, it was our first episode. We were trying to do some groundwork and things like that. But thank you for your insights and for your time. I really enjoyed this. And I think this discussion on Lear
was going to be
interesting and edifying. Yeah. Is that overstating it?
Mm-mm. It's better than eyesight, personally.
It's better than Space and Liberty. Better than Space and Liberty.
All right. Well, this has been an episode of... This has been the very first episode of The Play's the Thing. For Matt Bianco, for Tim McIntosh, and for all of us here at the Close Reads Podcast Network, I am David Kern. Thanks so much for listening, and happy reading.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to Quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.